NPR for 5 years and introducing the Zody office chair by Hayworth, online at sitforless.com.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera, presenting Impressions of Spain, featuring vocalist Ricardo Herrera, on Saturday, October 4th at 7:30 p.m. in the Fullinger Great Hall of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. More information is available at 333-6280.
What can your $25 do? Help build a member match fund for our fall pledge drive. Combined with contributions from your neighbors, your gift of $25, $50, or $100 or more has real impact on the vitality of WILL as a community resource. Send your check to WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, 61801, or give online at willpledge.org. If we all do a little, it can add up to a lot.
Ian Hobson performing the very familiar Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven, and he has stopped by the studios this afternoon to chat a little bit about himself, his background, and about Sinfonia de Camera. This is their 25th season here in Champaign-Urbana. I remember when that group started. In fact, I remember when Ian Hobson first came to campus. So it's astounding to me how fast the years have passed. But welcome, Ian.
Thank you. It is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. Let's start by talking a little bit about you. Can you tell me a little bit about your personal history? I know you were born in England.
I was born in England, in Wolverhampton, which is in the Midlands, very close to Birmingham. And I went to school. I moved around in England quite a bit because my parents were moving and job positions, and I ended up in Hereford, which is in the West Country, and did my early schooling there until I was 14, and then I moved to Coventry.
Mm-hmm. When did you start studying piano? At what age?
Well, we didn't have a piano in the house at the time, but I was making up tunes and on a toy piano, and so my parents got a piano when I was about four. And so I learned to play by ear before I had lessons. And I had lessons from the age of five.
Mm-hmm. Did you always want to be a professional pianist, or was it just a pastime for you at the
time? No. I think from pretty early on, I wanted to do something very significant in music with the piano. But I wouldn't say that I had the ambition to be a concert pianist. Exclusively, I was more interested in just music. I was composing and enjoying different aspects of music study.
So did you have classical music in your home then as you grew up?
I did, although my parents were not professional musicians. And in fact, only on my father's side was there any music. And my grandfather was an amateur organist. They worked in service industries. They worked for the gas board, so it was just amateur activities, amateur operatic societies on my father's part, and so I think I learned a lot from that too.
Mm-hmm. Do you have brothers and sisters?
No.
Mm-hmm. So, do you play any other instrument besides piano?
Well, I played a lot with keyboard instruments. I mean, I studied the organ. Ended up in Coventry, as I said, which was a very famous cathedral town. And the new cathedral, after the old one was destroyed in the war, the new cathedral was a very imposing place with a very fine choral tradition. And I studied the organ there. And so I played the organ. I also played the harpsichord. And more, as I studied later in Cambridge and Yale, I studied with Ralph Kirkpatrick, who was a very eminent harpsichordist in this country. I have to say that I studied the string instruments too, although I never played with any degree of proficiency. I studied the violin when I was young, and I studied the viola and the cello as a means to help me with conducting.
Yeah, I was going to say, even then you were laying the groundwork to right, be right. a conductor as well. Tell me now about your debut. What were the circumstances? And I know you won first prize at Leeds. Was that 1981?
That was 1981. Well, that was quite late on. I mean, I'd already been here for 6 years by then.
Right, man.
That was the end of the competition circuit for me, naturally enough. But I did some piano competitions early on. I was fortunate to win the Kosciuszko competition, which is a Chopin competition for people up until the age of 21, which takes place in New York. And I won that in 1974. And then just before I came to the University of Illinois in 75, I was in the National Chopin Competition, which is in Miami, which then sent me to Warsaw for the 1975 competition, in which I was in the quarterfinals. But it was the first really big international competition that I'd entered, and then subsequently I went to Van Cliburn competition and Beethoven competition, and ended up in the Leeds, winning the big prize in the Leeds in 1981.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of opened all kinds of doors for you, I imagine.
Yes, it was, of course, a very intense time of performing. And I remember taking a leave. I won the competition in September, and I took a leave for the second semester here in spring of 82, because I had just concerts every couple of days. I mean, it was ridiculous. I would be going back and forth from New Zealand back to Europe, to Amsterdam, to here and there, making recordings, and it was pretty intense. So I couldn't have taught with any regularity at the time I was doing that. And then things settled down. You know, I continued to teach and maintain a concert schedule during the semester without going away for too long. And mm-hmm. So it's worked out extremely well. And the support that the university gave me over the years is very much appreciated, because, you know, there are actually very few performers, active performers, who are teaching on a full-time basis. And it takes a lot of effort and energy on the part of the performer teacher, but it also takes a lot of support from the institution.
Would it be fair to say that most concert pianists today, I guess, got their first big break from winning a big international competition?
I think that yes, it's most. I don't know to say most, but there are a few who have avoided the competition route, and that was the case in the old days. I mean, I think people like Brendel, for example. We don't think of Brendel as having won a competition and then had his career launched that way. On the other hand, we think of Radu Lupu or Mari Pariah, and their career was certainly launched by winning the Leeds competition. And there are people now who, for example, the Chinese Lang Lang is celebrated, I suppose, because he won the competition in Warsaw. But in a way, it's the anti-competition aura about him, the the more publicity-oriented aspects of his career that grabbed the attention. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's difficult to say. I think probably there are so many more competitions now, but in a way they are devalued because of that. Uh-huh. You know, in the 1930s, 1940s, there were two or three competitions in the world, and so they became very important. Now there are many competitions, mm-hmm. and some with very good prizes, good concert opportunities, monetary prizes. But it's a very competitive world.
Mm-hmm. Now, you yourself very recently, in fact, as recently as yesterday, you returned from judging a competition in Russia.
Yes, I was in Moscow, and I played Chopin. Two pieces for piano and orchestra, not the concertos, but the Krakowiak, which is a shorter piece, and the Polish Fantasy. And I'm involved at the moment in recording all the works of Chopin, so this was an important step for me. But it was in conjunction with a competition for young pianists, maximum age 16, uh-huh. who played Chopin for the next eight or nine days when I was in Moscow. And this was fantastic to see these young people play with such aplomb and accomplishment, mm-hmm. to play Chopin, who is one of the hardest composers there is for the piano. And so I think we came up with some very, very good results. And it was remarkable to see people not playing like children, but playing with enthusiasm and maturity and complete assurance.
Exactly. I remember a few years back when they were doing the Stravinsky Awards, I was always just knocked off my feet by some of the playing of some of these kids that had to have even a little bench, you know, to step up onto the bench. And I remember asking Roger Shields, so how do you explain that these kids can come up and play like this? And he said, talent.
Yeah. That's right.
Now, since you claimed that first prize at Leeds, you've been very, very busy. And, well, as you just said, you were busy before that, too. And very much in demand, appearing with many of the world's top orchestras, including the Royal Philharmonic, the London Philharmonic, the Scottish National, the Royal Liverpool, Halle, Chicago, Philadelphia. The list goes on and on. And in fact, you were just telling me that you have a performance coming up with Chicago, who's appearing here tonight, but you're in a different appearance.
That's right. Next week, this coming weekend in Chicago. And it's concerning the great work of Modest Mussorgsky, the pictures from an exhibition, which was written originally for the piano. And that's the version that I will be playing. But the Chicago Symphony with Charles Dutoit will be doing the Ravel orchestration of this. And on Saturday, we both individually play these versions in Symphony Center. And on Sunday, we're jointly on stage at 3 o'clock in a performance called Beyond the Score, in which we will be doing phrases back and forth to show the differences and the meanings. And there will be also the projections of the pictures by Hartmann that inspired Mussorgsky.
Oh, very interesting.
And also discussions of the little differences between the piano score, which was actually arranged by tampered with, if you like, by Rimsky-Korsakov. And he said, well, you know, Mussorgsky, he didn't really know what he was doing, or he was writing stuff that's too wild. Let's calm it down a little bit, which is what he did. And then Ravel took that calmed down version and then made his orchestration from it. So what we're doing is showing the raw, granitic version of Mussorgsky for the piano solo.
That sounds very interesting. Now, your recorded discography includes a series from the London Pianoforte School, the complete cycle of Beethoven sonatas, which you performed in the Cranard, I recall. Mm-hmm. All the Brahms variations for piano, the Rachmaninoff Etude Tableau, and the 24 Preludes, the Chopin-Godowsky Etudes, Bach's Goldberg variations, and works composed for you by Lees, Liptak, Gardner. How do you keep track of all these composers and their performance styles and practices?
One day at a time. It's fascinating to study various different things. I mean, as a conductor and a pianist, I gain people say, well, how can you do both? What's it like? And I always say, with complete honesty, that one enhances the other. You know, of course, it's difficult to do two things at once or shortly. One after the other, but you really learn a lot, and I also learn from the other component of my life, which is teaching. I find that my teaching is better from studying and playing music and conducting music, and my conducting is better from playing the piano and vice versa. And so it's all music, and one learns from these combinations of activities.
A question that I know is a little bit naive, but I've always wondered, because I guess with each composer presumably adds a little bit to the repertoire and a little bit to the piano technique. So I'm wondering, a composer, you know, I mean, a pianist like, well, Mozart could do anything, so he may not be the one I want to ask really about. But a pianist like Mozart, who was considered, you know, a virtuoso in his time, would he have problems playing music by, let's say, Liszt or Rachmaninoff, with, you know, the wider hand spreads and, you know, different techniques?
Oh, yes. I mean, when you start crossing time zones, we don't really know. What Beethoven, who was innovative in the extreme and was kind of breaking pianos, trying to find the right instrument, the right sound, and the keyboard was expanding in the bass going down lower, and in the top of the keyboard going more, and the keyboards were getting longer, we were having more notes, more powerful instruments. But, you know, to ask me what would Beethoven think of, who was, let's say, writing his great late masterworks in 1820, assuming that he could hear well enough to answer this question, what would he think of what Chopin was writing in 1830? Who knows? I mean, it's such a leap. It's such a difference, even in spite of Beethoven's innovations and his anarchic view of the world. It's very difficult to tell, but all I know is that I think that he would appreciate it. Whether he could understand it,
sure,
is another matter.
Sure. Well, we've done quite a bit of talking, so let's hear some music next. One of the things I really like is to hear a piece of music that's very, very familiar and that have been given like hackneyed performances, and then just to hear it performed very, very well. And so let's hear a little bit of what we started off with, the Beethoven Moonlight Sonata, and let's hear you in a performance recorded on arabesque, the first movement of Beethoven's Moonlight. Thank you. A lovely performance. The first movement of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, of course, performed by Ian Hobson, who is here in the studios speaking with me this afternoon. I'm Roger Cooper. And if there's a question that you would like to ask Ian, then give us a call at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Or if you are outside the 217 area code, then call 800-222-9455. Now, Ian, you've recorded all of the Beethoven sonatas. What was it like working on them? Did it give you more insight into Beethoven as a person from studying his entire output in a particular form that was so close and personal to him?
Yes, I think that we could examine Beethoven through the string quartets or through the symphonies. But with the piano sonatas, piano was his first instrument. Piano sonatas go all the way through his life to an extent that the other things don't. It's really amazing to examine him from the early days of virtuoso pianist, student of Haydn, rebel, somebody who's writing music for himself to demonstrate his prowess as a virtuoso, and then through the more reflective compositional pieces like the Moonlight Sonata, which is part of a what's called sonata quasi una fantasia, that's fantasy sonatas which are joined together without pauses between the movements, and that movement that we just heard is very revolutionary in that he says just put the pedal down all the way through this piece. It's enveloped in pedal. It's just creating this this mood, and then on to the later sonatas, the great middle period, as we call them, sonatas, the Waldstein, the Appassionata, and then towards the five great last pieces, which are so difficult to understand, and even after repeated study, one doesn't really get to the bottom of them. But as Schnabel used to say, the pieces that are better than they can be performed, you know. So one tries all the time. But of course, to gain insights into some aspects of Beethoven's personality and creative process, the sonatas are the way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, since you came to the University of Illinois, you've had some pretty amazing students. The first one that comes to my mind is Abadajan Pratt, who has established himself as a pianist. What's it like teaching somebody with a gift? Does it keep you on your toes?
Of course. And I've had many gifted students. Abadajan was very special in that he came from normal Illinois. He came from this area. And when he was here, he studied as an undergraduate and came to me, I think, in his second year. But he was studying violin and piano. And there was quite a remarkable junior recital in which he played the Beethoven violin concerto on the violin and Opus 109 Beethoven on the piano. And not many people can do that. But yes, I had some other prize-winning pianists or pianists that have really gone on to establish themselves as teachers and musicians. Mm-hmm.
Does it remind you of yourself when you were a student and you had ideas of your own and your teacher had to kind of keep you in check until you learned the discipline?
Oh, yeah. I remember several of my teachers just, giving me a good lesson in discipline don't try to play too fast or too individually until you've learned the basics and really examine what's going on in the score, what you know about the composer, before you start interpreting.
Right.
Get to know, and that's a good lesson for everybody, I think.
I see we have a call from Sycamore. Hello, this is Roger. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and I've been intrigued by your discussion this afternoon. I wanted to particularly talk to a classical pianist because I have three different recordings of Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto, and the opening chords are played differently on each one. One of them plays it the way the music is actually written, and the other two performers apparently have difficulty with the left-hand chords and make sort of an arpeggio out of the chord, out of that left hand. And I was wondering if you can enlighten me a little bit as to whether that is because they really could make the stretch in the left hand but don't feel comfortable doing it in a live performance, or if they really just don't want to do it that way at all because it might cause some damage in their hand.
Well, Rachmaninoff was a, apart from being a great pianist, was a, quite a tall man, and he had very large hands. I think he had hands that were larger than mine. I think he could stretch a twelfth at the keyboard without even arpeggiating. So what he asks for at the beginning of the second piano concerto is a tenth in the left hand, which is from F to A flat. Uh-huh. And then he asks for some more notes as the chords grow bigger, and he puts more notes in between. So, you know, this is simply out of the question for many pianists who can barely stretch an octave. They have to arpeggiate. They have no choice. I think that sometimes when I'm playing something that I could play directly, I might say to myself, well, I think it'll sound better if I arpeggiate. So for me, it's a choice. I can say I'd do it this way or that way. But for somebody who has a smaller hand, they have to arpeggiate, and they have to make it sound as good as possible while doing that. So I would guess that that's all there is to it. You know, for example, Alicia de la Rocha, a Spanish pianist, who was very diminutive and had not a very large hand, did eventually record the second concerto of Rachmaninoff and the third concerto, and she managed to get around them and to play, but she would have to arpeggiate some of these chords.
So that's acceptable practice in all performances then?
Absolutely. No question. I mean, there are pieces that you might not be aware have exceptional stretches in them, in Schumann, for example, and certainly in Busoni, who was another great pianist of the late 19th century. They had very large hands, and they would just write these things, and they would imagine that the performer would decide how to play them as necessary. Yeah, I don't think it's an impediment that one cannot stretch. You can just figure out how to play in a very beguiling way arpeggios.
Fascinating. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your call, Sycamore. I see we have another call from Urbana. Do you have a question for Ian?
Yes, I don't have a question. I just want to, I live in Clark Lindsay Village, and I wanted to tell him we really appreciate hearing his students. They come every once in a while, and probably mostly before they have to play it at Smith Music Hall or something for a grades or something, but they are marvelous. So.
Well, thank you, and it's a very good thing for them. They very much enjoy the experience of being able to try out in front of a very enthusiastic audience.
Yes.
Their programs.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call. Let's talk a little bit now about Sinfonia da Camera. How did the idea for Sinfonia come about?
Well, I came here in 75, I founded the orchestra in 1984, so I'd been here for a while. And I had been conducting the Juvai Symphony as assistant to Paul Vermel during those intervening years, and also conducting my faculty colleagues, who you also know, the people who were here at that time, in the Musicians Union Trust Fund concerts or concerts in the summer or whatever. And we enjoyed working together very much in that manner. And around this time, there were several new faculty members coming to the campus, and the old Walden String Quartet was the kind of backbone of the string faculty up until that time, and then came new people. Sergio Luca came here teaching the violin, and then following him, Catherine Tate. Peter Schaefer was not here at that time, but I had been performing in New Zealand, and then he came back to this country. And so it seemed the right moment to draw upon these people's talents. And we put this together, this idea, with the help of Jerry Tessin, who was on the continuing education faculty here at that time, and really helped me as the first manager of the orchestra. And then the orchestra, the idea of founding this orchestra appealed very much to our dean and the School of Music director at the time. It just happened. We weren't sure how it was going to work, how it was going to be funded, one thing led to another. But it came out of a mutual desire to work together with my faculty colleagues here. Mm-hmm.
And now here we are 25 years later in the orchestra. It's very, very highly respected and very successful.
Well, it's thanks to the hard work, dedication of the people in it, the people in the community, the university.
Its founding director, I think. Before we talk about your upcoming season, let's do a little bit of reviewing about the last 25 years. You've had many major artists, Marilyn Horne, Menachem Pressler, Gil Shaham, Zubin Mehta, John O'Connor, Christopher Parkening, William Warfield. Do you have a favorite collection? I mean, a favorite
recollection?
You said
Zubin Mehta. It wasn't Zubin Mehta. It was Itzhak Perlman.
Itzhak Perlman, excuse me.
Pinchas Zuckerman as well. Uh-huh. And we had those two. And when we had Perlman, that was a real watershed event. And that was in 1988, I believe. He was at the height of his popularity. And just to announce that he was coming to play with us, the hall was already sold out. Mm-hmm. So that really enhanced our season very much. We had Marilyn Horne, Barry Tuckwell also, a wonderful horn player. It's been great to work with these people and also to do some touring that we did near and far. I mean, mm-hmm. we went to London a few years ago. We performed in New York in 1990, and most recently into China, the Chancellor's Initiative last year.
How was that?
It was wonderful. It was really a great cultural exchange, and because we had not only our orchestra playing, but we had sometimes the institutions that were inviting us, the universities would have their young players, mm-hmm. Or their intermediate orchestra play before we got on the stage. And so it was really a nice collaboration. Mm-hmm.
And do you find that music truly is the universal language?
Yes, certainly. I was in Moscow just now, as you know, and everything is Cyrillic there, and I don't do very well with Cyrillic, so music was the only way that I could communicate.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear a portion of a concert that was given September 12, 1992. Pinchas Zukerman was the soloist, and we'll hear a portion of the lovely, lovely Romance by Dvořák.
Thank you.
Also on that program was Mozart's fifth violin concerto. It's very nice. Is your approach to music different with orchestra as opposed to piano? Is there, do you think like this is, for instance, Dvorak's piano style, and now I have to think of his orchestral style, or is it Dvorak's style?
I think it's probably just Dvorak. You know, if you talk about Dvorak, the piano music, the chamber music is, of course, wonderful, but the piano music is less well known and less celebrated and less good. With Mozart, it's not the case. I mean, you have great piano music, great operas, great symphonies. What a great piece that romance is. It's nothing to do with piano. It's just pure music.
Just lovely music. What's it like to conduct another pianist in repertoire that you yourself perform? Is there a constant sense of, oh, that's nice, I like the way he did that, or I wouldn't have done it like that? You know, are you more critical?
No, I'm not critical at all. I just enjoy very much to be able to concentrate on the orchestral part and to have the interplay with the soloist. I mean, working with Menachem Pressler, who I also studied with, Claude Frank, has performed with us in the classical repertoire, Charles Rosen, in not only Schumann and Beethoven, but in Elliot Carter. You know, one learns so much from these collaborations.
If you have a question that you would like to ask Ian Hobson this afternoon or pass on a comment, give us a call at 333-9455. If you're outside the 217 area code, 800-222-9455. Let's listen now to what happens with a collaboration of three great pianists, one as composer, one as conductor, and one as soloist. Pianist John O'Connor, that was from a concert given December the 6th, 2002. To quote another great keyboard artist from an earlier century, François Couperin, he believed in the ability of music, with a capital M, to express itself in prose and poetry. He says, if we enter into the poetry of music, we discover that it is more beautiful than beauty itself. I think that movement expresses that very well. And we're quickly running out of time, so let's talk a little bit about the upcoming season. Tell us who do you have scheduled?
Well, we have an opening concert on October the 4th with Ricardo Herrera, and it's Spanish music or French music inspired by Spain. So we have music by Ibert, we have the Bizet Toreador song, some Montsalvage, Debussy, Ravel. And then we have also the Brandenburg Concertos, the six Brandenburg Concertos in November. We did these six pieces during the 10th season, and it's nice to revisit that with our faculty artists during this season. We have the Nutcracker collaboration with the CU Ballet, as usual, in December. And then we have an English program in February with Chaba Adeli, our principal violist, playing the Walton Viola Concerto. We have Menachem Pressler, who you mentioned before, who's going to play this time the Mozart G major piano concerto. We have the Rosenkavalier, which is a semi-staged concert version, let's say, on April the 3rd. And then I finish with Beethoven Second Symphony, Haydn Symphony, Clock Symphony, and Mendelssohn Concerto Number 1, and Moscheles Concerto Number 8, which will be a kind of modern premiere because I'm orchestrating it and the orchestration doesn't exist anymore in the world.
Great. It sounds like a great season, and thank you for stopping by, Ian Hobson. And I know this is a very, very busy time for you, and we want to thank you for sharing some of your time with our listeners. And thank you for Sinfonia da Camera and the wonderful, wonderful season ahead.
Thank you very much, Roger.
I'm Todd Gleason, and this is time now for a settlement price update from the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. Of course, those two marketplaces have closed, all under the auspice of now the CME Group. Here's the way settlements came through this afternoon. December contract in the wheat pit is 7.55 top, a low at 7.25 and three quarters, and a settlement price at 7.50 and a half, up 12 and three quarters of a cent this afternoon. March futures, 7.73 and three quarters the high, the low at $7.48 and three quarters. Settlement price, $7.70 and a quarter, 12 and a half cents higher. May contract in the wheat pit, 7.87 and a quarter the high, the low at $7.62. Settlement price at 7.83 and a half, up 12 and three quarters. In July, soft red winter wheat, 7.98 and three quarters the high, the low at 7.74. Settlement price at 7.96, up 13 and three quarters. Next year, September, 8.14 the high, the low at 7.90 and a half. The settlement price at 8.12 and a half, up 13 and three quarters. There's a difference between the soft red and the hard red. One of those is that the sowing season, or the planting season, which is now for both of those crop, is running behind for the soft red, but the hard red, which is mostly planted in the western states, is on time. December contract, a gain of 7.5 cents today from Kansas City, where it's traded. 7.86 and a half the high, the low at 7.65. A settlement price at 7.81 and a half, up 7.5 cents. That's what it looks like for the hard red, and or rather for the winter wheats. But the spring wheat, which is planted early in the spring of next year, very early in the spring, is like this on the afternoon, a 12 and three quarter cent high. 12 and three quarter cent settlement price higher on the afternoon at $8.11 and a quarter for that December contract. Now the corn pit in Chicago. December futures there, 5.61 and three quarters the high, the low at $5.49 and a half. And the settlement price, $5.60 and a quarter of a cent, up 1 3/4. March futures, 5.79 and a half the high, the low at 68. Settlement price at $5.78, a penny and three quarters higher. In the May futures in the corn pit, 5.90 the high, the low at 79 and a quarter. Settlement price at $5.89 and a quarter, up 2. July contract, 5.99 and a half the high, the low at 5.89. Settlement price at 5.98 and a quarter, up 1 3/4. And September corn, $6 the top, the bottom at 5.92. Narrow trading range, just 8 cents. We'll call that narrow in these violent and volatile times. 5.99 and three quarters was the settlement price for the September corn next year, up 3 1/4. December futures for 2009 settled at 5.98 and three quarters, up 2 3/4. December oats today, 3.43, a settlement price up 2 cents, the high at 50, the bottom at 38 and a quarter. In the March contract, a settlement at $3.60 a bushel for the March oats, up a penny and a half. Soybeans now, nearby November contract. The harvest month finished 18 cents lower, $12.11 the high, the low at 11.68 and a quarter, and a settlement price at $11.87 a bushel. November beans down 18 cents today. January futures, 12.27 and a quarter the high, the low at 11.85 and three quarters. A settlement at 12.03 and three quarters, down 18 and a quarter. In the March contract, 12.41 and three quarters the high, the low at 12.02. Settlement price, 12.18 and a quarter, down 18 and a quarter. In the May futures, 12.51 the high, the low at 12.15. Settlement price at 12.30 and a quarter, down 16 and three quarters. July futures, 12.55 the high, the low at 12.25. July settled on a Tuesday afternoon at $12.41, down 17 cents in the soybean pit. October bean meal, 326.90 the high, the low at $319.30. Settlement price at $325.30, two bucks higher. The December up two as well. $331.90 the high, the low at $323.50. Settlement at $330, up two for the December soybean meal. December bean oil futures $1.80 lower, a settlement price at $48.23. The high at $50.48, the low at $47.72. And the nearby October, a final trade down $1.81 at $47.74. In a moment, I'll bring you the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange during this National Farm Safety and Health Week. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Here's how the livestock numbers finished up from the CME Group's Mercantile Exchange side. Live cattle contract October, 102.20, a settlement price down 25 cents. The high at 102.45, the low at 101.85. A settlement for the live cattle October contract, 102.20, down 25. December futures, 103.65, the high, the low at $103 even. Settlement price at $103.45 for 100 pounds of live cattle, down 45 cents. In the February futures, 104.25, the high, the low at 103.55. Settlement price at $103.67.5, 47.5 cents lower. April futures, 104.65, the high, the low at $103.95. Settlement price at $104.22.5. Down 50 cents. Feeder cattle September futures, 107.90 the high, the low at 107.60. Settlement price at 107.60, down 55 cents. October, 106.90 the high, the low at 106.20. Settlement price at 106.60, down 45 cents. November feeder cattle, 106.40 the high, the low at 105.70. A settlement price for the November contract at 105.95, down 52.5 cents for the November feeders. January futures, 106.15 the high, the low at $105.45. Settlement price at 105.85, down 45 cents. October lean hogs today, 68.65 the high, the low at 67.90. Settlement price at 68.45, 20 cents lower. December futures, 66.80 the high, the low at 65.95. Settlement price at 66.30, a dollar and a nickel lower. February lean hog futures, $72.65 the high, the low at 71.70. Settlement price at 71.87.5, down 72.5 in the April. 77.35 the high, the low at 76.65. Settlement price $77 even, down 75 cents. February pork bellies $96, the top for the day, the bottom at $92.50, and a settlement price at $95 even, $1.27.5 lower on the afternoon. Here's what the forecast for the two-state region looks like at this hour. From our own chief meteorologist, Ed Kieser, he says today skies will be mostly sunny. The highs will range from 78 near Lake Michigan to 88 in the very far south. Tonight in northern and west central Illinois, partly to mostly cloudy, a few showers in the far northwestern part of Illinois toward daybreak. Elsewhere, clear to partly cloudy. Lows today will range from 52 in southeastern, some eastern rather, in southern.